You could have died, Claire, he said. If Pan hadn't checked on you when she got home from the beach, I would be picking out your casket right now. I'm sorry.
You're sorry? You were unconscious, Claire, knocking yourself out, literally, over the goddamned chandelier.
Two arms left, Claire thought involuntarily. Then she thought, he's right. I've been brainwashed. I am not myself. How to return to myself? Quit? Leave Locke? Tell Isabel to take her petite soiree and go to hell? The door opened, and the doctor swung in.
Well, he said, I hear you're lucky to be alive.
They were at an impasse. Claire promised Jason she would stay out of the hot shop for 1 week, but doing so pushed her past her self-imposed deadline, and she only had two arms left, just two. She could do it, she knew she could. She had pulled two perfect arms in an hour, and she had it down now, the formula, the rhythm. She said to Pan, I'm going to work for 1 hour. Will you check on me in an hour? Pan touched her front pocket, where she kept her cell phone. Claire knew this meant that Jason had told Pan to call him if Claire tried something like this. Never mind, Claire said. I won't work. But, of course, she sneaked out only seconds after Pan pulled out of the driveway to take the kids to the beach. She found the door to the hot shop secured with a padlock. She called Jason at work. You're a jerk, you know that?
You saw the lock? He said.
She hung up. She nearly called Siobhan, but Siobhan would take Jason's side. She had already taken Jason's side, saying when she dropped off Tupperware containers of chicken salad and marinated cucumbers, It's not worth what you're doing to yourself, Claire. So Claire called Locke, even though Locke was in the office and not free to talk. She told him what had happened. The chandelier, the heat, the sweat, the fall, the hospital, the fight, the padlock. He's a dictator, she said of Jason. He thinks he's my father. He's not my father.
No, Locke said. He's not.
Keeping me out of my own hot shop, keeping me away from my work, is wrong.
Wrong, Locke said.
What am I supposed to do? Claire said.
Leave.
She looked out the window at her shackled hot shop. And go where? Locke was quiet. Right. It was easy for him to take her side. Anything to put him in opposition to Jason. Anything to make Jason the bad guy and him the hero. Okay, now Claire was defending Jason. Jason wasn't letting her in the hot shop because he cared about her well-being. The chandelier was making her crazy. She did need a break. Leave? And do what, fly to Ibiza? It was unfair for Locke to tell her to leave when he had no intention of leaving himself. Claire? There was a voice in the hallway. Truly incredible, Jason was home at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I have to go, Claire said, and she hung up. She opened the bedroom door and found Jason standing there, his face a livid purple. His arm outstretched and trembling, in his palm, was the key.
Here you go, he said. Take it.
She took it. He turned on his heels and marched out. She held the key until it started to sweat in her hand. This was what she wanted. Jason was trying to make her feel like it was wrong. It was wrong. All of it was wrong. She had been abducted. Where was the old Claire? Missing. Dead. Gone. She closed her eyes, and the thought that came to her was this. Two arms left. She filled a thermos with ice water and headed out back. 49 minutes and 18 tries into it, she had her 7th arm. Into the annealer, one more arm. She was giddy with her impending triumph. Tomorrow was July 8th, and Isabel would arrive, and Claire would be done. The backbreaking work would be finished. Blowing the cups out would be as easy as blowing bubbles with the kids on the back porch. Claire went back to the pot furnace and took another gather. The first key to success was getting the right amount of gather on the punty. This looked perfect. Claire took the gather to the marvering table and rolled it in the precious pink frit. The gather cooled against the table, so Claire went to the glory hole and reheated. Then she took the gather to the bench and rolled it, grabbed her pliers and pulled and bent and twisted and rolled. She went back to the glory hole, got the piece good and hot again, tweaked it some more. She thought of the swoop she felt in her stomach when she saw Locke. That swoop was what she wanted to recreate with this glass. She thought the arm looked pretty good, pretty close. She heated it up. She tweaked it a little more. And feeling optimistic, she pierced the arm lengthwise with a long needle. This was delicate surgery, a procedure that had ruined dozens of good arms, so that there would be a thin tunnel through which to thread the wires. It was impossible to tell how good the arm was, however, until she held it up to the globe. Impossible that she would have pulled two perfect arms in a row. But yes! When the piece had cooled enough to pick up with tongs, Claire saw it was the missing piece of the puzzle. It fit, like Cinderella and the goddamned glass slipper. Impossible, but true. Claire had hit a home run. She had pocketed the eight ball with two banks. She had won the pot with a royal flush. She had served an ace. She had skied a black diamond run in knee-deep powder. Ringer, hole-in-one, touchdown, goal! Her self-righteous elation, however, was her worst enemy. She dropped the eighth and final arm on the way to the annealer. She was shaking with joy and nerves, and truth be told, thirst, and it shattered at her feet. Later that night, as she lay in bed, all cried out, all done apologizing to her husband, and to God, and to herself, she recalled the myth of Sisyphus. It was his job to roll a boulder up a hill again and again and again. The task was never ending. When Claire was a glass-blowing apprentice, her mentor had told her that story. Satisfaction was not to be gained from finishing the task. Satisfaction was to be gained from the process. She feared that, like Sisyphus, she would never finish. The last arm of the GD chandelier was her boulder to push and push again. It was her punishment. The caller ID said Isabel French, and Siobhan couldn't help herself. She picked it up, then immediately regretted it. Isabel French wanted Siobhan to cater a party that very night. Well, not a party, exactly. More like an evening at home. Une soirée intime, Isabel said, and Siobhan thought it was a joke, her speaking French, because it was her last name. But no, Isabel spoke in earnest. The soirée intime was the invitation stuffing for the summer gala.
I'm thinking all-American picnic food, Isabel said to Siobhan. Fried chicken, deviled eggs, my grandmother's bread and butter pickles. If I give you the recipe, you'll make them?
Make them, Siobhan repeated. She did not want to cater this intimate evening at home. She wanted to turn down everything related to the summer gala. She did not want to make Isabel's grandmother's bread and butter pickles.
I know it's last minute, Isabel said. So I'll pay you for your time and effort. Say, $3,000?
Siobhan coughed. How many people?
I'm not sure exactly. Less than 10.
Siobhan started scribbling down ingredients in her notebook.
What time?
7.
I'll be there at 6 to set up, Siobhan said.
She could be bought, especially since Carter had lost $600 on Wednesday and $400 on Sunday with the Red Sox. He had to stop gambling that fucking instant, she told him, or she was going to call a hotline. He promised he would. But that's how all addicts were, right?
They promised until they were blue in the face and carried on behind your back. Siobhan had opened a bank account that Carter knew nothing about, and all the checks from this summer were going right into it. He wouldn't be able to touch a penny. Siobhan had catered at Isabel's house before and had gotten all of her ogling out of the way the first time. The house was technically on the wrong side of the street, not on the harbor, that is, but situated on a little hill overlooking the harbor. It wasn't a huge house, but it was spacious and airy and perfectly appointed. There was a koi pond in the front foyer, which would have shouted overstatement in anyone else's house, but in Isabel's house it was a delightful surprise. She had a bright, well-equipped kitchen, which opened onto the enormous room she normally used for entertaining. The soiree intime, however, would take place out on the sun porch, where two gaming tables had been set up side by side and topped with smooth brown leather surfaces. Isabel had ordered floral arrangements of purple and white irises, white gerbera daisies, and fragrant Asiatic lilies that were as big as dinner plates. One wall of the sun porch was screened windows overlooking the water, and Siobhan was to set up the buffet along the back wall. She had made the fried chicken, as well as potato salad, marinated string beans, corn fritters, deviled eggs, and the pickles. The pickles had been a snap, and they turned out perfectly. Siobhan was keeping the recipe to use again. She had also baked chocolate chip cookies and peach and blueberry hand pies. The All-American picnic had taken all day to prepare, but the first thing Isabel did when Siobhan arrived was to hand her the check. $3,000.
Thank you, Siobhan said.
Thank you, Isabel said. She leaned over and kissed Siobhan on the cheek, which took Siobhan by surprise. Isabel was holding a rather full glass of wine, though she didn't seem drunk, just excited and nervous. Was the invitation stuffing a big deal? Siobhan had called Claire while she was filling the deviled eggs to give her the update. Claire was aghast to find that the invitation stuffing was being catered at all.
She's calling it a soiree intime, Siobhan said. An intimate evening, chez French.
Oh, Jesus, Claire said. Well, thank heavens I didn't offer to have it at my house. It would have been crying children and a bag of Fritos, and Jason kicking us out at 9 o'clock so we could watch Junkyard Wars. Siobhan had laughed at this. They had laughed together. Siobhan wanted to ask Claire if Locke would be attending the soiree intime, but she hadn't been able to mention Locke's name even once since the day Claire confessed they were having an affair. Siobhan did not bring any help to Isabel's house. Carter was doing a dinner party for 40 people in Sconset, an event they now jokingly called La Grande Soiree. And he'd taken Alec and two Dominican busboys/dishwashers with him. Isabel gamely pitched in, helping Siobhan carry dishes from the van to the buffet table on the sun porch. When they were finished, Siobhan stopped to look at the invitations. They were set up on one of the gaming tables, a box of invitations, response cards, envelopes, a dish of water, a tiny sponge, and a roll of stamps at each place. Siobhan lifted one of the invitations carefully from the box. It was as heavy and creamy as a wedding invitation. Siobhan felt her ire rise up. The amount of money spent on these invitations, how many were there, 2,000, was enough to pay for daycare for one of Nantucket's children for a year.
Lovely, Siobhan said.
Mm-hmm, Isabel murmured. She sipped her wine, then picked up a sheet of vellum printed with names and waggled it in the air. These are the committee members, she said. I noticed your name is on here.
Is it? Siobhan said.
She checked the vellum. Mrs. Carter Crispin, and gave a little laugh.
Well, I told Claire I'd help out, but I haven't done very much.
No, Isabel said. Half the people on the list are people I recruited, and most of them don't even speak to me. They won't help, won't lift a finger, they might not even attend. But because they agreed to serve on the committee, they will send a check, and they lend their name to our event. But
They're ghosts.
Ghosts, Siobhan said, eyeing the vellum.
I know it drives Claire mad, having people on the committee who aren't willing to roll up their sleeves, but that's the way the game is played.
There were footsteps, and a woman entered the sun porch, lugging a large instrument trapped in a black body bag.
I'm playing in here, the woman said to Isabel.
Dara, hello. Yes, over there in the corner, I think, don't you?
Isabel turned to Siobhan.
This is Siobhan, the caterer.
Siobhan, this is Dara, the cellist.
A cellist, Claire said.
She had been inside for 15 seconds, just enough time to take a glass of champagne from Siobhan's tray and catch strains of cello music floating in from the other room.
She hired a cellist?
Flew her in from New York. She plays with the symphony.
No, Claire said,
but Siobhan didn't answer. It was her rule, strictly enforced, not to fraternize with guests of any event, and that included Claire.
Let's go out after,
Siobhan whispered, in an attempt to end the chit-chat. Claire said,
I can't.
Siobhan gave her a scowl, which Claire did not see because at that moment, Locke Dixon walked in. He smiled warmly at Siobhan.
Hello, Siobhan.
Hello, Locke. Champagne?
Claire was smiling too, and drinking her champagne, and fidgeting with the straps of her sundress. Isabel swooped in from God knows where.
Locke.
They kissed on the lips as Siobhan and Claire watched. There they were, Siobhan thought. The cook, the thief, his wife, her lover, or something like that. Locke said,
Do I hear music?
Isabel said,
Dara is here. I know how you love the cello.
Claire turned to Siobhan. Siobhan looked into the koi pond, which babbled happily at their feet. Gavin Andrews walked in, stiff and smarmy as ever, followed by Edward Melior. Siobhan ground her molars together. $3,000 was not enough compensation to deal with Edward. If she had thought for one instant that he would be here, she would never have taken the job. It seemed amazing to her that she had ever, ever kissed him, hugged him, rubbed his feet, chewed his ear, ruffled his hair, slept with him, declared her love for him, agreed to marry him. She flashed back to the instant that she had flung his engagement ring at him, screaming,
It's over, Edward!
His face had screwed up in pain. That memory she found satisfying. But because caterers were, among other things, actors, she smiled.
Champagne? Gavin? Edward?
Gavin took a glass with a sniff. Edward took a glass, then reached out, grabbed Siobhan's chin between his thumb and forefinger, and kissed her flush on the mouth. Siobhan would have slapped him had she not strictly enforced the no-hitting guests at any event rule. Hello, beautiful. Edward said. She would have stabbed him in the gut with a serving fork. Regrettably, the taste of him lingered on her lips. Gin. He had been to a party before this. And she didn't have a hand free to wipe it away. Even worse, Siobhan felt a pulse between her legs. The kiss had aroused her. Impossible. She abhorred the man. Involuntarily, she thought of pressing him up against Isabel's sub-zero refrigerator. She thought about making him so hot that he begged for her. He had kissed her with authority, with ownership. How dare he? She hated his self-assurance. The tray of champagne wobbled in Siobhan's hands, and for a second, she pictured it toppling into the koi pond. Damn, Edward. She had not dropped or spilled anything in more than 2 years. Edward approached Isabel and shook her hand. Siobhan stole a glance at him, at his shirt, neatly tailored across his shoulders, at the bulge of his wallet in the back pocket of his khakis. They drank a lot, only 6 people, and Siobhan could not keep the glasses full. And, too, she was busy making sure the food was perfect. She warmed the fried chicken, and softened the honey pecan butter she had made to go on top of the chicken. She fried the corn fritters, last minute, on Isabel's Viking range and brought them out piping hot. She offered the fritters to Edward first, and he popped one in his mouth and burned his tongue. Siobhan clucked.
Careful. They're hot.
No question about her role. She was the hired help. This never bothered her. She had a strong work ethic and almost no pride of the deadly sin variety. She liked to listen, to eavesdrop. She did it all the time on the job. Even when serving her best friend and her ex-fiancé, she was invisible, a fly on the wall. She, like Dara the cellist, was very pleasant background music. First, she watched Claire. Claire's cheeks were flushed. She drank quickly. She chinged her fork against her plate more than once, and she fussed with the napkin in her lap as if it was a bird she was trying to calm. She was sitting next to Locke. This was the first time Siobhan had seen them together, side by side, and it was revelatory. Siobhan knew the truth. She was the only one. But it was like looking at the optical illusion of the old lady and the young lady. At first, your eyes saw only the old lady. But then, when someone pointed it out, aha, yes, the beautiful young lady. How could I not have seen it earlier? It's so obvious. Locke and Claire were turned toward each other. They spoke addressing each other. Under the table, Siobhan noticed from behind, their legs were touching, though just barely. It was happening under everyone's nose. Siobhan was also acutely aware of Edward. He was drinking heavily, more gin, splash of tonic, a quarter lime. She knew how he liked it. And he was being funny and charming as always, but he was punctuating his stories with long, penetrating looks at Siobhan that seemed to rise and swell with the strains of the cello. Siobhan caught him looking once, and he did not look away. They were stuck there, hooked together. His look was saying, well, what else would it say? I want you. And Siobhan's look was hopefully both enticing and defiant. You can't have me. Isabel's voice sliced into Siobhan's thoughts. Claire, have you bought your table yet? There was a weighty pause. Isabel asked the question loudly, at the exact time that Dara finished a movement, so that the room was suddenly silent and the question took on the import of an announcement or a challenge to be risen to. Claire's answer was meek. Not yet. But you will take a table, right? $25,000? That way you'll be up front next to me and Locke. Everyone looked uncomfortable, except for Gavin, who merely looked interested. Take a $25,000 table? Siobhan thought. That was absurd. Well, not for Isabel and not for Locke. Not for Edward, maybe. But for Claire, yes. $25,000 was a new car. It was a year's worth of mortgage payments. It was not something Claire would or could toss away in one night. Isabel, Siobhan decided, was an evil woman for asking Claire in front of everyone. Look at poor Claire. Her cheeks were burning, and now the red splotches were popping out on her chest. Siobhan was in the process of offering the table more pickles. She had not dropped or spilled anything in more than 2 years, but what if the pickles were to end up in Isabel's lap right now? Adams Fisk said, Everybody donates what they're comfortable with. No one expects Claire to buy a $25,000 table. Why not? Isabel said. She's chairing the event, as am I, and I'm taking a $25,000 table. It's expected that we lead by example. Locke took a breath, as though he were about to speak, and Siobhan thought, Yes, stick up for your girlfriend. Prove to me that you love her. But Edward, who honestly could not keep his wallet in his pants for 1 second, said, I'm in for a $25,000 table. Claire raised her face. She had been staring at the lonely deviled egg on her plate. Me too,
she said.
Claire,
Adam said.
Claire, Siobhan thought. Are you out of your mind?
What? Claire said. I am the co-chair. Isabel is right. It sets an example. And I've put money aside.
She was lying.
Her gaze was fixed back on Mr. Egg. Siobhan whisked Claire's plate away and nudged her discreetly. Claire looked up. Siobhan shook her head.
You don't have to play these people's games.
It was like she was always telling Carter, anteing up money you don't have doesn't make you ballsy, it makes you stupid. Locke jiggled the ice in his glass and said,
That's great, everybody. Thank you. It's great for the cause.
They moved to the next table and got going on the invitations. It was dark now. Siobhan brought out dessert and coffee and cordials. Dara, the cellist, packed up and went out front to wait for her cab. Siobhan cleaned up in the kitchen. This was normally her favorite part of the evening, wrapping up leftovers for the boys, getting ready to go home. But tonight, right now, Siobhan was rattling around, distracted, upset. It was so many things. Claire, Locke, Edward, Carter and his gambling, Isabel. Siobhan decided that from now on she was only going to take jobs from nice people, good people. She would not work for Isabel French again. There was a glass of champagne remaining on the silver tray, no longer chilled, but who cared? Siobhan drank it down. She felt better then, lighter, less serious. Claire's problems were not her problems. They were such good friends that it seemed this way sometimes, but no. Siobhan felt hands on her waist and then a warm mouth on the back of her neck. She was well trained in self-defense, and instinct nearly had her elbowing Edward in the sternum. She refrained, however, and managed just enough twitch to shrug him off.
Go away, Edward.
You're beautiful, Siobhan. And you taste like a peach.
The hot dishwater was fogging Siobhan's glasses, so that when she turned, she couldn't really see him. But then her lenses cleared, and he was on her, kissing her. Again she was aroused. Appalling. She had spent so long disdaining Edward and his annoying, if tangential, presence in her life that she had forgotten he was a skilled kisser. But she would never have spent 4 years of her life with someone who wasn't a skilled kisser or an extraordinary lover. Edward had been an extraordinary lover, very considerate, not as animalistic, maybe, as Carter, but attentive and confident. Yes, she remembered this as he was kissing her. Then she pushed him away.
Stop it, Edward.
I'm crazy about you. Look at me.
She looked. She was very, very angry with him. But oddly, her anger propelled her toward him rather than away from him. She wanted to punch him, to pound him. He had never been able to see her for who she really was, her own strong, clever, capable person, and she wanted him to see her now. She led him into Isabel's pantry, which was big enough for a king-size bed. God, what a hypocrite she was, so self-righteous with Claire, and now look at her. The pantry was dim. It smelled very strongly of truffle salt, which was, coincidentally, one of Siobhan's favorite smells. Siobhan could hear the other guests chatting out on the sun porch. She should check on their drinks, light the citronella candles. She would, in a minute. Over Edward's shoulder, she spied tapioca, baking powder, baking soda, a jar of black peppercorns, a jar of pink peppercorns, a tin of Coleman's dry mustard, and a small crystal jar of truffle salt. 3 ounces of the stuff, worth about $40. Edward was looking at her expectantly. She liked this. She was driving the bus. She was in charge. She inhaled deeply, and Edward inhaled deeply also, as if they were playing a game of Simon Says. But Edward either didn't notice the heady scent, or he noticed it and didn't know what it was. The man understood nothing about food. Was she going to kiss Edward again, here in Isabel's pantry?
She was not.
Help me take some things out to the van, Siobhan whispered.
He agreed happily. When he turned to leave the pantry, Siobhan popped the jar of truffle salt into the pocket of her chef's jacket. What was she doing? She felt like an incorrigible teenager, the kind who dyed her hair fuchsia, pierced her tongue, and hung around Piccadilly Circus. Thieving from a client. She put the truffle salt back on the pantry shelf.
Edward was lingering by the kitchen sink.
Siobhan pointed to covered dishes and platters drying upside down on dish towels, and Edward picked them up and followed her outside. The night air surrounding Isabel's house smelled like rugosa roses and honeysuckle, and the only sounds were the crickets. A car pulled up to the end of the driveway, and Edward and Siobhan both watched as Dara and the cab driver wrestled the cello into the back of the cab. Then the cab disappeared, and the lights that their movements had turned on turned off again, just like that. It was dark. Siobhan set the platters safely in the back of the van, as did Edward. Then he grabbed her by the hips and they kissed, and his hands went right up inside Siobhan's chef's jacket. She was consumed once again with fury. Wasn't it just like Edward to assume that he could flip Siobhan like an egg over easy? Wasn't it just in accordance with his view of the world to assume that she would feel the same way about him as he felt about her? She did not feel the same way. She was livid, and she would tell him so. She had no intention of following Claire into the dark forest of adultery, despite the fact that Carter had been unfaithful and untruthful with and about the family's finances. Siobhan was going to make Edward see her and hear her, and then she would rip herself away. But at that second, something happened. Edward stopped. He pulled back. He touched her face, ran his thumbs over her cheekbones, then over her lips. He pushed her glasses up, just as he used to when they were dating. Siobhan had always loved this gesture. She had to admit that in all her life, no one had paid as close attention to her as Edward. She thought of the calla lilies he'd sent when Liam broke his arm. The bell had rung, and she opened the door, saw the delivery person with an armload of calla lilies, and knew they were from Edward. I still love you, he said. I haven't stopped loving you for one second. Oh, Siobhan said. She knew this to be true, and yet the words caught her by surprise. Or else it was his tone of voice that caught her by surprise. It was very tender. You hurt me, Edward said. When you left. When you turned right around and married Carter. My heart broke. Siobhan nodded. She was too stunned to speak. You didn't feel the way about me that I felt about you, Edward said. You were right not to marry me in that case. But here it is, more than 10 years later, and I'm still in love. Siobhan's anger shrank until it was like a pebble at her feet that she could kick away. She did not allow herself to revisit the demise of her relationship with Edward very often, mostly because she had behaved regrettably, throwing the ring in Edward's face and 6 months later marrying Carter in Ireland. She didn't like to see Edward because seeing him reminded her of the person she'd been then, a woman who would break an engagement and immediately take up with another man. Siobhan had not allowed Edward any closure. When he came to her house to talk, Carter was there, and Siobhan had asked Edward curtly to leave. Awful. She still had the ring, the beautiful and expensive symbol of Edward's love and commitment, in her jewelry box. The ring taunted her. She had not been able to get rid of it, to take it to a pawn shop or sell it on eBay because... Why? Because of something Siobhan herself did not understand. Because she had been waiting for something. She had been waiting, maybe, for tonight. Siobhan pressed her head against Edward's chest. Edward was a good man, a good person. He would be a wonderful father and an amazing provider. Siobhan had not loved him enough or in the right way, and there was no crime in that. But there was a crime in not behaving like a decent human being. Facing Edward all these years, even the blurred glimpse of him as they passed each other in their cars, had meant facing her worst failure. She couldn't apologize, however. She didn't have the words at her disposal, and she feared anything she said would sound lame or overwrought, not to mention 10 years late. So she raised her face, and she kissed him, as softly as she possibly could. And the kiss stirred her. It excited her in a way she had forgotten she could be excited. And soon, they were kissing crazily. They were two people in a movie, kissing and sucking and pawing each other. She was going to follow Claire into the dark forest. She was going to shag Edward. She would sin. But it would be ameliorated, in a way, by Siobhan's making things right with Edward. She would be giving him something he'd been waiting for 10 years. Where? There, in the back of the van. The back of the van was cluttered with dishes. Her chef's jacket was now open, exposing her camisole underneath, and Edward's shirt was unbuttoned at the top. She could see he was ready to go, and she was certainly ready. Her mind flickered to Claire, Isabel, Locke. All still inside, right? Blotting glue on the envelopes with the dainty sponges, peeling stamps, discussing the names of the people on the invitation list. He's the one with the house on Shawkamo Road, whose wife died of... And then, the next summer, he married a 25-year-old. Was anyone looking for Edward or Siobhan? Most certainly not. Everyone inside was drunk anyway. My car, Edward said. The hood of my car. Siobhan thought he was kidding. It would be bad enough when she confessed to Father Dominic about the adultery, but imagine the look on Father's face when she told him it had happened on the hood of Edward's Jaguar. But Edward had a point. The hood of his car was tucked under the branches of a large tree. Even in the dark, it was in shadows, and it was the car parked farthest from the house. Yes, hurry. They were sneaking now, tiptoeing over the crushed white shells of Isabel's driveway. Siobhan felt lawless and heady. Was she really going to do this? It seemed so. Just the one time. And it was Edward, an old lover, not a new lover. Did that make it any less treacherous than what Claire was doing? Claire was in love. That was her justification. Siobhan was not in love with Edward. She had fallen out of love with Edward, or had never been properly in love with him. She had lied to him about that, or had misrepresented herself. The lie had broken his heart, and she felt guilty. And so now here she was, sinning in order to make things right. It made sense to Siobhan, but it was also perfectly fucked up. Would she go to hell? Would she and Claire go together? She smelled somebody's cigarette.
Who's out there? A voice shouted.
Edward whipped around. Hello? He said. He held Siobhan with one hand, and the other hand flew to his shirt buttons. Siobhan clenched her chef's jacket together in front and peered around Edward. Gavin Andrews came crunching around the corner. When he saw Edward and Siobhan, he shouted, Ah! And Siobhan screamed, Ah! Gavin put a hand to his heart.
Jesus, he said. You scared me. I thought there was a burglar out here.
A burglar, Siobhan said, thinking automatically of the truffle salt. But she had put it back.
No burglars, Edward said. It's just us.
Yes, Gavin said, taking a drag off his cigarette. I can see that. They stood for a moment in awkward silence. Okay, Siobhan thought. She was not going to shag Edward. Gavin Andrews, of all people, had arrived like a sign from God and put a stop to it. Now Siobhan had to worry about what this looked like. Did it look like she and Edward were about to shag on the hood of Edward's car? Oh, God, Siobhan hoped not. It was safe to bet that half the gossip on the island of Nantucket started with Gavin Andrews.
I was helping Siobhan put dishes in her van, Edward said. Somehow he had gotten his buttons done and his shirt straightened,
and he looked perfectly normal and presentable. But Siobhan looked like she had just fallen out of bed after a legendary ravishing.
How's everything inside?
Oh, Gavin said. He blew a stream of smoke through his nose.
Fine.
They had both had a lot to drink, and it was very late, nearly midnight, but an opportunity like this didn't present itself often, so they took it. They drove to Altar Rock and looked at the moon. It had been nearly 2 weeks since they'd been alone together, and although they'd talked every day, they hadn't really talked, and so as Claire lay in Locke's arms, she told him all of the things that she'd been saving up for him, that she loved him, that she missed him, that her heart was lonely, starved, suffocating without him. She wasn't sure how much longer she could go on this way. He kissed her neck.
The Eiffel Tower,
he said.
The post office.
I know, she murmured. I know. Play cards, eat Big Macs, go to the movies, do the things that other people did, do them together. She'd had a lot to drink, and it was affecting her. Here she was, in the middle of the night, in the most beautiful place in the world. Altar Rock, the highest point on the island, was not much more than a hill, but it looked out over the moors and ponds. This was her home, in the moonlight. She was only going to be alive once. Shouldn't she be happy? She didn't know how much longer she could stay married to Jason and have Locke stay married to Daphne. She and Locke were in love. She, desperately and stupidly, blindly and completely. She was a slave. A goner. She would give up everything for him. But was this true? Could she really imagine a future with Locke? What would that look like? Would she move out? Inconceivable. Would he move out? More conceivable, but where would he go? He couldn't live with Claire in Jason's house. Would they both move out and get a place together? Where would the kids go? With her, presumably. She could not imagine life without her kids, but neither could she imagine Locke living with her kids. She fantasized about a life with Locke, but she realized that this would have to take place in an alternate reality, one where they had no jobs, no responsibilities, no ex-spouses or children to care for, no friends, no connections. They would have to move to Ibiza, two displaced strangers, and start over. Claire felt like a marionette. Locke could swoop in and clip all the strings that were tying her to her current life. But then she would collapse, lifeless. She would be a person without form. The worst thing about adultery was that it made you see your life for what it was, something that was nearly impossible to escape. Claire cried a little at this, and Locke squeezed her and whispered,
"Hey, it's okay. I'm here. I love you."
"I know," she said. They saw each other so infrequently now that when they did have time together, it became weighted and tangled with emotion. This was Claire's fault. She had worries to soothe and problems to fix. She was becoming tiresome, even to herself. "I should go," she said. He released her. She wanted him to say,
"Not yet,"
or "so soon," but he simply agreed.
"Yes," he said. "It's late."
Claire's head was buzzing from the alcohol. Claire checked on each one of her kids, all of them sleeping, even Zach in his crib. Jason was snoring softly in their bed. He had taken the kids for pizza and ice cream and to the playground at Children's Beach. "Mom has another meeting." He seemed resigned to life without her. He was making the most of it, enjoying it even. And Claire had a somber vision of Jason packing the kids up and whisking them away, leaving her alone.
God, she deserved it.
She lay awake fretting about this. Where would they go? Yellowstone? Bar Harbor? They would go someplace Jason could fish. And then she worried about other things. Locke. The chandelier. Money.
She had made a promise she couldn't keep. She had agreed to take a $25,000 table. Part of her had known all along that she would do this, that she would never be able to eat crow and say, "Sorry, I can't afford it." It was a matter of pride in front of Isabel, in front of Locke. She had lied and told everyone at the table, as well as Siobhan, who was floating around the table, that she had set money aside. This had sounded feasible, but it was not remotely feasible. Claire had gone over their finances again and again. She and Jason had sizable IRAs, which could not be touched, and they had $42,000 in savings. There was no way Claire could demolish more than half of their savings on the gala. She had told herself that after the gala she would make an effort with her business and solicit a new commission from Mr. Fred Bulrush or Jeremy Tate Friedman. But now Claire couldn't even pay the electric bills for the shop, much less get ahead to the tune of $25,000. She had considered going to the bank and taking out a loan and paying it off over the next calendar year. That seemed like the most responsible course of action. Until she thought of Matthew. Matthew had millions and millions of dollars. Now that Bess was out of the picture, there was nobody and nothing for him to spend it on. It couldn't hurt to ask. She vacillated between this train of thought and the fear that indeed it could hurt to ask. Matthew could flip out, call her a vulture. She hadn't spoken to him in 12 years. She had called him out of the blue and asked him to play a free concert, and he had said yes. Wasn't he doing her enough of a favor? She would pay him back, with interest. But to this he might respond that he wasn't a bank, and he wasn't a loan shark. He had once upon a time been her friend, but he didn't appreciate being preyed upon now. In this vein, she had talked herself out of calling several times, but now it was dark. It was quiet. She had had some drinks, and she had enunciated a promise that could not be denied. She dialed Matthew's number.
Hola.
Matthew? It's Claire. Claire Danner.
Buenas noches, chica. I knew it was you because you're the only person who still calls me Matthew, other than my mother.
Am I?
You are. How are you? It must be the middle of the night there.
It is, Claire said. He sounded sober. This was a good thing. Sober at 9:30 at night, home, and not out at the clubs drinking or carousing with 17-year-olds to take his mind off Bess.
I didn't wake you, did I?
No, he said. I was just lying on the sofa with my Berlitz.
Which language?
Spanish. You can never know enough Spanish and Portuguese. You may think the two languages sound alike, but they are, in fact, quite different.
You got a D in Spanish, Claire said. What's the deal?
Gives me something to do. Keeps me out of trouble. I'm shooting air baskets, grabbing at straws. I don't know what I'm doing. Well, I'm coming to see you. 6 weeks.
I can't wait. I miss you.
I miss you, too.
Claire swallowed. Listen. I called because I have the world's biggest favor to ask you.
The answer is yes, whatever it is.
I need to borrow $25,000.
Silence.
Oh, God, Claire thought. I got myself into a real mess with this gala. I'm the co-chair, and my other co-chair is a very wealthy woman named Isabel French. And she has managed to bully me into taking a $25,000 table for the gala. And I don't have $25,000, and I can't even broach the possibility with my husband or he will kill me. So I ran through all these other options, and the one that seemed the least painful was to borrow the money from you, but I'll pay you back, I swear.
Silence.
Oh, God, Claire thought. Had he hung up? What if he didn't play the gala at all now? The possibility had not occurred to her until this very second. Matthew?
I'm looking for my checkbook.
You are? You mean you'll lend it to me?
Well, we can call it a loan. But to paraphrase my favorite ex-wife, if you send me a check, I'll rip it up.
But Matthew...
Claire, relax, it's just money.
Right, but it's a lot of money.
Do you remember when we were kids, he said, and your grandmother sent you $100 for your birthday?
Claire racked her brain. A check from her grandmother? 16th birthday? Was that what he was talking about? Yes.
What did you do with it?
We got our ears pierced.
Right. You paid for me to get my ear pierced, and you paid extra for a diamond stud. You told me I would never be a proper rock star unless I had a diamond stud, and you bought yourself 14-carat studs, which were cheaper.
Yes, Claire said. She actually did remember this, driving to the mall in Rio Grande and sitting in a chair at the piercing pagoda. They convalesced in Sweet Jane's kitchen, both of them holding ice cubes to their earlobes, trying not to cry.
How many times did you give me $5 so I could put gas in the Volkswagen?
Yeah, but that was only $5.
How many times did you pay for kettle corn or slushies? How many times did you pay for beer?
You had a job. You paid sometimes, too.
You paid for dinner before the prom.
My father gave me the money.
But what I'm saying is, when I didn't have it, you paid for me. No questions asked. You gave me everything you had. There was no line drawn between what was yours and what was mine.
He paused.
I'd like it if things could still be that way. So, I'm going to write this check, and I don't want to hear about you paying me back.
Oh, she said. Jesus. She thought she might cry, but she was too relieved to cry. Thank you.
Does this $25,000 table mean you'll be sitting up front?
Front and center.
Good, Matthew said. Then it's worth it.
When she hung up, it was 1 a.m, but Claire felt like it was full daylight, bright and sunny. Her chest cavity, she realized, had been filled with concrete, but now the heaviness was gone and she could breathe. Matthew would send the check in the morning, and Claire would have her $25,000 table. Problem solved. Should she press her luck? Something was telling her yes. She wasn't at all tired, and the effects of the alcohol were fading. She pulled a Coke out of the fridge, exchanged her sandals for her clogs, and left the house quietly for the hot shop. She spent a long time looking at the chandelier. Maybe that was the difference. She turned it in her hands, scrutinizing, meditating. Other times when she came into the hot shop, she was in a hurry, stressed, worried. Would she finish today? How long would it take? How many tries? Her forearms were in a constant state of fatigue and ache. The muscles were becoming ropey. But now, Claire studied the chandelier. She pictured the arc and dip and twist of the final arm, and she saw how the piece would look, completed. She pulled it on the first try. As she knew she would, she rolled the gather in the frit, and as she pulled and twisted, the final arm came into being. She pierced it with a steady hand. She held it up. Yes? No question about it, then gently set the arm in the annealer. Tomorrow, she would blow out the cups. Piece of cake. She went back into the house. 1:45. Suddenly, she was very sleepy. She shed her clothes, washed her face, brushed her teeth, did her ritualized rinsing of the sink basin and wiping of the granite vanity top. Then she fell into bed, feeling light, clean, and empty, as though she didn't have a care in the world. Once the invitations had been mailed, response cards arrived every day, some bearing credit card numbers, some bearing checks. Gavin kept the checks in a neat pile on his desk, and when he got a stack of 10, he went to the bank to deposit and skim. Claire dropped off a check for $25,000.
Gavin could not help mentioning this to Locke. Claire took a $25,000 table.
She did?
Yes. Locke rose from his desk and came over to look at the check, as Gavin knew he would.
Well, she said she was going to.
And she did, Gavin said. The influx of money from the gala tickets made Gavin giddy. His stockpile was getting bigger and bigger. He had moved it out of the utensil drawer, in anticipation of his parents' arrival on August 1st, and stuffed it in a green L.L. Bean duffel bag under his bed. It was so much money, he was afraid to count it. And yet, he was no longer afraid of getting caught. The letter to the women's shoe company, as it turned out, had been perfectly fine. He marveled that he had ever feared otherwise. His affairs were in order, his trail was covered. Meanwhile, the people all around him were committing indiscretions. First Locke and Claire, and then, the other night, Siobhan Crispin and Edward Melior. He should get out of theft, he thought, and into blackmail. Isabel called now every day to see who had responded, who had merely sent donations, who had requested seating with whom.
Did the Jaspers respond?
They did not.
What about Kavanaugh?
Sent a donation.
How much?
$1,000.
That's it?
That's it.
Isabel sighed. They have more money than Beckham. They could have sent 10 times that much. But they didn't. Because of me.
Gavin did not know how to respond. He felt he was growing closer to Isabel. He felt that perhaps she was calling so often because she wanted to talk to him.
Did Kimberly Posen respond?
Not coming. Sent a donation.
Not coming?
No, Gavin said. But she sent $2,500.
This was met with silence. She used to be my best friend, Isabel said. I'm her daughter's godmother.
Oh.
You're sure she's not coming?
I'll check again, he said.
Gavin wanted to make Isabel happy. He wanted to give her good news. When she next called, he said,
Your friend Dara Kavinsky is a yes, and so is Astor Wyatt.
Dara is the cellist, Isabel said, and Astor did the invitations. He's my graphic designer. Why is it the only people who are coming are the people on my payroll?
As the days passed, Gavin found himself thinking more and more about Isabel French. She was sexy, he decided, alluring, classy, and disillusioned. He was perhaps the only person in the office who realized that everyone Isabel had personally invited to the gala had said no and sent a donation.
It's because of my divorce, Isabel said. It's like a disease. People are afraid they'll catch it. I hate being single. Was this a clue for Gavin to ask her out? She had been so nice to him at the invitation stuffing. She had seated him next to her. She had touched the back of his hand in a way that sent a shiver up his arm. And at one point, she had nudged him with her foot under the table. Gavin had ended up being the last to leave. There was a full moon, and Isabel invited him to walk outside to see her moon garden. She had a circular plot planted with night-blooming white flowers. Evening primrose, she said, and 4 o'clocks, which were waxy and luminous in the moonlight. And she had a moon fountain, a sphere made of honey onyx, a little bigger than a bowling ball, that glowed from within as water trickled over it and made it spin. The moon garden was the kind of magical place that Gavin was hoping to discover in his travels. He was in awe. To his embarrassment, he'd teared up. Isabel was holding his arm. She was wearing heels in the grass, and they'd both had a lot to drink, and he wondered if he should kiss her. But in the end, he'd been too intimidated. A woman with enough aesthetic imagination and money to create a moon garden, she'd designed the fountain herself, she said, was beyond him. Now, of course, he regretted his cowardly decision, and he wondered if he would ever summon the balls to ask Isabel out.
he entertained a fantasy where he bedded Isabel French. At her house, because he could never in a million years take Isabel to his parents' house, or maybe he could, before the 1st of August, and pretend it was his. Would she buy this? He and Isabel could become lovers. He would not need the duffel bag full of money because she would support him. But here, his enthusiasm waned. Despite his lack of ambition, he did not want to be a kept man, and so he returned to the notion of grabbing a fistful of cash out of the duffel bag and taking Isabel for a romantic dinner at the Chanticleer, then seducing her. Cut. The escalating flirtation with Isabel made the incessant ringing of the phone more palatable, but the calls were mostly from teenagers asking how to get Max West tickets. In the beginning, Gavin took great pleasure in saying, "This isn't Madison Square Garden, you know. It's a charity benefit. The tickets are $1,000 apiece." Gasp.
$1,000?
"Yes," Gavin said. "Would you like to buy a pair?" Click. Now, however, he had tired of that song and dance. It made him feel like Scrooge or the Grinch, announcing such an outlandish price, quashing hopes. Then there were calls from the tent people, the tables and chairs people, the underwriters, how much signage, where, for how long, the production people, lights, speakers, ferry reservations, would the crew house have a grill? And the caterer, Genevieve, whose purpose in calling, it seemed, was merely to double-triple check that she still had the job. Perhaps the rumors of Siobhan and Edwards being together had made it farther afield. Gavin was single-handedly piecing together the gala. He secured ferry reservations for the enormous truck that was bringing over the tent. He confirmed that there would be housing, meals, and a grill for the production crew. He got the alcohol permit from the town. He tried to talk Isabel off the ledge.
"The Van Dykes are a yes," Gavin said. "Do you know them?"
"No," Isabel said. "They must be friends of Claire's." Gavin, pointedly, did not keep any notes. With each phone call, he became more and more indispensable. Claire was effusive. "God, thank you, Gavin. What would we do without you? You deserve a raise. In September, when this is over, I'm going to bring it up at a board meeting. I'm going to tell them what an enormous help you've been. I could not do all this myself. I simply do not have the time." Daphne called. Since discovering Locke and Claire in the office back in April, Gavin had done his best to keep his conversations with Daphne short and to the point. "Oh, hi, Daphne. Would you like to speak to Locke? He just stepped out. I'll tell him you called." Gavin could not gossip with the woman while keeping a huge secret from her himself. He had limits. He even, at times, experienced guilt. Daphne had no idea about her husband's infidelity. Or rather, she had every idea, but she had identified the wrong target. Was it cruel keeping the news of Locke and Claire from her? Or was it kind? Gavin chose kind. He was old enough now, mature enough, sophisticated enough, to realize that really, what you didn't know, what you might never know, couldn't hurt you. This day, Daphne did not want to talk to Locke. She was adamant about that from the beginning.
"I'm calling to talk to you, Gavin. I want to tell you something."
Surprisingly, the something she had to tell him was not about a third party, not about the postmaster dating a 20-year-old Bulgarian house cleaner, not about Jeanette Hicks's being addicted to diet pills, which gave her insomnia, which led her to prowl the Cumberland Farms at 4 a.m. and shoplift a 99-cent bag of caramel bugles. Instead, Daphne said,
"Locke tells me you're doing a fantastic job. You, my friend, are a wizard. I hope you're planning a nice long vacation after this is over, someplace exotic. You deserve it, darling. I'm proud of you."
"Well, thank you, Daphne," Gavin said. He hung up the phone, impressed. A conversation with Daphne, and not one sideways reference, not one barbed word. Only sincere praise, or a passing along of praise because she wanted him to know. He was proud of himself. One night,
When Gavin was getting ready to leave at 5 o'clock, heading home, where he would sit on his parents' deck, looking at the ocean, drinking wine, smoking, listening to Mozart, reading his Lonely Planet guide to Southeast Asia. Vietnam was sounding better and better. Locke stopped him.
Gavin?
Gavin stopped by the door. Locke's tone of voice was ominous. Was this it, then? Gavin wasn't prepared. Think. Whip out the weapon. He had the knife sharpened in his mind. All he had to do was wield it. Gavin smiled expectantly, his mind a whirlwind. What was it he had planned to say?
Before you contact the authorities, let me say one thing. I know about you and Claire. I came into the office one night in April. I saw you two, together.
Locke was slow to speak. He looked pained.
God, this was torture.
Gavin stood there, caught in the force field of the insidious thing he had done, stealing from the very cause he was working so hard to promote, and he was overcome with remorse and nearly unbearable disgrace. Locke was going to put a name to his acts: theft, robbery, embezzlement. This acknowledgement alone would kill Gavin. Committing the crime was one thing, but having it exposed was quite another. Had he learned nothing from taking advantage of Diana Prell in the broom closet, or from the debacle at Cap and Lehigh? Gavin experienced what could only be described as a pure, unadulterated shame. He was, as they said in certain Asian cultures, losing face. Gavin understood this turn of phrase now. Even as he stood, waiting for Locke to lower the hatchet, his face was stiff and burning. He could not look Locke in the eye, so he gazed beyond Locke, out the 20-paned window into the late summer afternoon. Locke rose and approached him. Instinctively, Gavin backed up, but he was not fast enough to get away. Locke caught him, clapped him on the shoulder.
I know things haven't been easy around here, Locke said.
Gavin's eyebrows shot up. He thought of Rosemary Pinkle and how disappointed she would be. She was such a nice woman, and she believed in Gavin. Tomorrow, he was supposed to join her for drinks in her garden with a niece she wanted him to meet.
With the gala, I mean. All the phone calls. Isabel pushing you one way, Claire pulling you the other.
Gavin nodded, uncomprehending. His parents were due in next week. They would not appreciate arriving to scandal. Gavin wasn't quite sure what they thought of him. He had never been quite sure, but he knew it wasn't terribly good. He hadn't measured up somehow.
And I just want to say thank you. You're doing a great job.
Locke squeezed Gavin's shoulder in emphasis, so firmly that it hurt.
I am?
Gavin said reflexively. He breathed out his fear.
I'm so grateful. If this gala comes off in the legendary way I think it will, it's in no small part because of your hard work.
Oh, Gavin said.
But you're not off the hook yet, Locke said.
No, Gavin said.
The worst is probably still to come.
You think? Gavin said.
Yes, Locke said.
Chapter 10. He blows it. There was only one time previously in his life that had been as frenetic and difficult as this summer. He had been in the process of buying a company, one bigger than his own. He had someone else handling the financing so that he could focus on the negotiations, which were primarily with an older gentleman named Gus McAvoy, who owned the other bigger company and who was reluctant to sell. Most of Locke's dealings were classic M&A stuff, pages right out of his business school textbook, but that didn't make it any less stressful or consuming. And to make matters more complicated, Daphne was at home with Heather, who was 18 months old and driving Daphne crazy. Daphne had undergone surgery to remove her ovaries a few months before, and she was still in pain and was suffering from a hormonal imbalance. When Locke got home, with all that was going on in the office, this was sometimes not until 8 or 9 at night, Daphne was alternately whimpering, fuming, or despondent. Her life, she said, was tedious beyond belief. It was Sesame Street and peekaboo and endless putterings up and down the street while Heather picked a dandelion or put a pebble in her mouth or ran ahead, stumbled, and cried. Heather threw her food instead of eating it. Heather spilled things. She broke things. She ripped pages out of Daphne's magazines. She fussed unless Daphne read The Runaway Bunny 300 consecutive times. She had to be held. She screamed in protest every time she had her diaper changed. Daphne took her to the playground, and one of the other mothers made a sideways comment because Daphne was reading The New Yorker while Heather was playing in the sandbox. "I was not cut out to be a mother," Daphne said. "I want to put her up for adoption." Locke had laughed. He thought Daphne was kidding.
"We're not going to do that," he said.
"Well, you don't get a vote," Daphne said, "because you're never home."
Those days had been hard, but they'd survived. Locke bought the company with Gus McAvoy's blessing. Heather grew quickly into a charming little girl. For a while there, her mother's best friend. And Locke told himself he would survive this summer. The gala would make them enough money to fund all of their programs and initiatives and start an endowment, and he and Claire would be able to get back on track. Right now, however, the relationship was floundering. Claire blamed him, and to avoid further arguing, he accepted the blame. He apologized. There was little he could do. What had happened was this. He and Daphne had been eating dinner on their deck. It was hot, so they'd ordered sushi, washing it down with silver gin fizzes. This sounded pleasant in the telling, but Daphne was growing more belligerent and demeaning with each sip of her drink, talking about this person and that person, wondering aloud about the sexual preferences of these near strangers, and then, ultimately, wondering about Locke's sexual practices with Isabel French. Rather than engage Daphne in that fight once again, Locke stood up to clear the dishes, and there, ascending the stairs from the front door, was his daughter, Heather. Locke nearly dropped the plates. She had come home. The vineyard, Heather said, was crowded and noisy. There was traffic. There wasn't anything for teenagers to do, and Desiree's parents never wanted to drive them anywhere because of the traffic, so they sat in the house, bored, and they bickered. Desiree said, "If you hate it here so much, why don't you just go home?" So, here she was. Locke hugged her.
"You can always come home, sweetie. Your rooms are all ready for you. God, am I glad to see you."
Daphne was still on the deck, possibly carrying on her invective with herself. Locke didn't want her to see Heather yet. He didn't want her to ruin it. Heather might leave as suddenly as she'd come. As it was, she would be here for more than 4 weeks. It was a gift he'd never expected. It did not sit well with Claire. She was naturally happy for Locke, happy that Locke was happy, but Heather's presence put a limit on when they could see each other. Now, after work,